everyone. Welcome to the Black Dog Institute's eMental Health in Practice podcast for healthcare professionals, where we discuss topics relating to mental health and relevant e-mental health tools and programs that can assist you in providing care. I'm Phoebe Holdenson-Kimura, a GP with an interest in mental health. This podcast was recorded and produced on the lands of the Gadigal people, and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present, and emerging. This podcast is a distillation of some of the important information from webinar 56 on the topic of making the most of mental health questionnaires. We had two fantastic panelists. Dr. Peter Baldwin is a Senior Clinical Research Fellow and Head of Clinical Research at the Black Dog Institute. His research focuses on technology-enabled mental health, and he's also a practicing psychologist. Dale Skinner is our lived experience representative and lives with bipolar too. Dale is a passionate advocate for helping provide a better understanding of mood disorders for both health professionals and people living with mental health challenges. In this podcast, we discuss the history and development of mental health questionnaires, what they can and can't be used to do, and how to use them effectively and communicate their results with patients and clients in our clinical work. Just a reminder that all the resources mentioned during the podcast will be available in the episode description on your device. I guess we hear a lot about psychometrics, and for those psychologists amongst us tonight, you might have done a lot of study on psychometrics at university, but for the rest of us, it sounds like, I don't know, a term that could mean all sorts of different things and is used in lots of different ways. But Peter, can you just clarify for us, what do we mean when we talk about psychometrics?
Yeah, it is used in lots of different ways in lots of different places. But it's a sub-discipline within psychology, and it's really just an attempt to put numbers to things like cognition and emotion. There's things that we can't actually observe. It's one of the ways that we put numbers to that so we can kind of study and understand it. So lots of people think of just sort of neuropsych as psychometrics, but it's a very sort of broad umbrella that a lot of things fall under.
So within that broad umbrella, it sounds like mental health questionnaires, which we're going to be talking about tonight. I think it's really interesting with all these things to have a think about the history of them, because it gives us context as to how they were developed in the first instance and why. Peter, can you talk us through some of that history?
Yeah, it is really helpful because then we understand what they're for and what they're not for. So they were developed, you know, as a research tool, and really to give researchers the best sort of way of estimating someone's sort of level of psychological distress. And really not necessarily something that we were doing sort of in the clinic. It was a really long period of time when psychologists were just in the laboratory and we weren't in the clinical space at all. And so sort of psychometrics made its way into clinical practice, but it's easy to forget that they're not what they're intended for and what they're not intended for. So they're certainly not meant as a diagnostic tool, and they're not sort of created that way. They're not created to measure the severity of someone's illness. So someone's sort of score on the DAS is not the same as the severity of their depression, and we'll go into why that's the case. They weren't designed to guide treatment at all. So someone's, we know from the research that someone's psychometric scores don't actually predict the kind of treatment that they should get and how they're going to respond to that treatment. So researchers can quantify someone's personal experience to put numbers to it a little bit. It was a way for us to sort of measure variance in different groups. So one group might be particularly high relative to another group, and those numbers allow us to do that as well. It really was just that idea of researchers guessing what a participant's mental health status is in order to make the kind of estimates that we make when we're, you know, when we're looking at big data, when we're looking at population. So the K-10 is a great example of this. The K-10 was an epidemiological tool. It was never developed for clinical use originally, but everyone probably on this call is very used to using the K-10 as a clinical instrument.
And I think you shared with me previously that there's a tool that we use quite commonly that's also been developed primarily by, you know, pharma, big pharma.
Yeah, so the PHQ-9 and the GAD-7, they use all over the world for all different reasons, certainly a lot clinically, but they're developed by Pfizer. So they were funded and developed by Pfizer for use in clinical trials of antidepressant medication. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of fine-tuned for that purpose, you could say. Mm-hmm. And so there's some situations where they work really well, and there are certainly studies where they don't work particularly well at all. But it's actually really hard to get the studies that they don't work in published, because there's a lot of belief that it's the instrument is not the problem. It's so robust. It's actually the researchers, whereas it's really a file drawer problem where we just don't, our voice isn't loud enough to say, hey, this doesn't actually work some of the time.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And that I have this sense that it's moved into the clinical, you know, some of these tools have moved into the clinical space without necessarily having the evidence to back them up at the time. And so it's always, that evidence coming after practice type thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I think that this just brings up a whole broader sort of philosophical question around measurement, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we get a little bit attached to our questionnaires sometimes, and certainly in mental health, we get attached to our labels. We love our buckets because it helps us sort of talk about things in a common language, maybe understand things, decide what treatment should look like. But we forget that the buckets that we use in mental health, like symptom scores and like the DSM categories, they're not things in nature. They're not actually things out there that we've observed. So it's not something you can put under a microscope. It's not a pathogen. It's actually something that we've decided on. We've decided that these things go together. And then we go out and we look for the things that we've decided exist. So interestingly, when we try and model these things statistically, they don't always fall out. The mental health is much more complicated than that. But it's important to remember when you're measuring something, when you're measuring someone's anxiety symptoms, we've decided what those anxiety symptoms are, and then we've developed something to measure that. So it means it's part of it, but there's a whole bigger picture there that we're missing if we just focus on that one thing.
No, that's true of a lot of what we do in that mental health space. And I think, yeah, what you're saying is that the lived experience is so much richer, and there's a whole narrative that you could never capture with anything else. And we're not trying to either, are we? Yeah.
No, exactly. That was never the point. I think a lot of psychometricians look at how mental health questionnaires are used and they kind of tear their hair out thinking, no, this is not what we meant. But, yeah, they've taken on a life of their own, unfortunately.
Yeah, that common usage. Yeah. Does any of this resonate with you, Dale?
It's spot on. I mean, you can't. I can tell you, I've got 46 years of experience of mental health, more than probably most on here, because I've lived with it, and I can't measure it. I couldn't use a questionnaire, invented by a pharmaceutical company to measure my mental illness, because it's different. It'll be different in an hour as it is now, and it'll be different next week. So, it was good to see that not many people are still using it as a diagnostic tool straight out.
So we've talked about why mental health questionnaires were developed and how they were developed, and that over time they've sort of undergone, there's been some change and also application of these questionnaires in different ways. And I know you've touched on this a little bit already, but what is it that the questionnaires are able to tell us and not able to tell us in the clinical setting?
Yeah, well, I don't want this to be a gotcha moment for all the people who sort of vulnerably disclose that they're using the questionnaires for things like diagnosis. But they're certainly, they don't tell us that, unfortunately. They really don't tell us if someone's coming to us with a particular problem, you know, what's the history there? What brought them to this sort of place and what's keeping it going? They don't give us any psychosocial context. So they can't really flesh things out like that. Mostly there are some very big questionnaires that try but still don't quite get there. And they don't tell us what treatment should look like. But they, you know, as George Box will remind us, some, you know, questionnaires are useful and for some reasons. So they tell us, you know, the frequency or intensity of patients' experience, how often are things happening or how bad is it? They help us do those comparisons to other people. So we know that everyone feels a certain level of anxiety. It helps us kind of understand, okay, well, what are most people doing? And then what's our patient doing? What's actually happening for this person? Is it, you know, worse than it normally would be? They sometimes give us the individual context. So if we look at questionnaires for things like social anxiety or OCD, they might have, you know, measures in there of the types of situations where things are happening, but only sometimes. And I think the last point's the most important one. It's really, you know, it's a great place for hypothesis testing. It brings out some question marks and we can start to flesh those out in a conversation without it being too sort of concrete or prescriptive, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think perhaps that's what people were referring to when they said that they used it for a diagnosis, is that it would open up the beginning of a conversation perhaps. But no, that is really important, I think, to go back to the basics of what we're doing about this and sort of the underpinning philosophy, because sometimes we just get caught up in the, you know, in the everyday clinical practice type world. So now that we've talked about why they were developed and how, what they can and can't be used for, I think what's very important is to convey that in a helpful way to the patients and the clients that we're seeing. There's certainly going to be some pre-existing beliefs or attitudes, I think, towards these questionnaires. And we've got to be really careful that we, you know, couch the use of them and introduce why we're doing them and how we're using them in a way that helps people to understand our process, because otherwise I think people can come away from it thinking, oh, well, my anxiety score was high, so therefore I've got anxiety or whatever. So now we're going to be taking a deep dive into some of Peter's put together some really great communication tips that we could be using as we work through questionnaires with our patients and clients.
Yeah, it's always a bit of a fraught one. What do I share and what do I not share? You know, everyone is going to appreciate this anecdote, I think, because during the pandemic, I was, you know, helping lead a mental health clinic for health professionals. And what we got a lot was people coming in who'd done questionnaires, and that was their light bulb moment. Mm-hmm. Where they thought, oh, actually, I'm way worse than I thought I was. It's a very classic health professional thing to think that you're traveling absolutely fine. So there can be those light bulb moments where you're able to have a conversation with someone and say, well, actually, this is a good bit worse than what we'd sort of, you know, what other people might be experiencing at the moment. Or, you know, like here, we don't want to say is, you know, put those diagnostic labels, oh, you've got severe anxiety, start sort of hypothesizing in a diagnostic direction, or you might have an anxiety disorder here, or, you know, your anxiety is abnormally high. We might use that term statistically, that it's outside or like a normal range. Or my favorite one that I heard from a client, the anxiety scores described as being through the roof. I don't think anyone wants to be told their anxiety scores through the roof. I'm sure that person already knew their anxiety was through the roof. So I guess that, you know, on the right is a sort of an example of how I might do it, and I'm sure Dale, you can come in and tell us how we should be doing it.
Yeah, you're spot on there. I'm sure you're going to cover it. Don't use medical terminology. Use plain English. We'll catastrophize enough ourselves. You know, we're enough of drama queens. We don't need, you know, and mental health or not, we all can be a bit dramatic. So, you know, using that sort of language, and it's hard, it will set someone back. If you say, okay, you've got an anxiety disorder, or use the term anxiety, straight away, because it's linked negatively in society, straight away, you know, it's going to be stuck in our heads and we're going to struggle to get it out.
Yeah, I think the power of the words that come out of a health professional's mouth can't be really understated. And yeah, so I mean, I just try and normalize a check-in to say it looks like here, it kind of looks like your anxiety is a bit higher than we would expect, or a little bit higher than usual. You know, does that sound right? Is this getting it right or not? Tell me a little bit more. And not necessarily using any of those sort of, yeah, as Dale said, overly medicalized terms or terms that put someone in a bucket.
And what we're seeing there with the example you've provided is that we provide, you know, give a bit of a summary of what the score looks like, but then we open up an open question.
You know,
and it's that sort of shared sense making, isn't it? Is this, you know, does this make sense to you? Is this representative of your experience? What do you think about it in general? And then the ideally a conversation flows from there. Now, with many of the mental health questionnaires, and particularly with the DAS-21, which we'll be talking about in more depth later, there is sort of a response profile. And so you can look at specific responses that were given to the questions or specific patterns that seem to be coming out. Again, what are some of the helpful and not so helpful ways to talk through that?
Look, psychologists love the response profile. We can, you know, get to look for response patterns and outliers and all of those sorts of things. But, you know, sometimes it can actually be useful conversation starter as well. So, again, avoiding sort of over medically sort of terms, you know, you're hyper-focused on sympathetic arousal, probably not going to mean much to someone, or it might actually terrify them because they might think, well, that's a diagnosis or a disorder. If you want to ask why someone's, you know, why did someone answer that way? It's probably sometimes we can accidentally sound a bit accusatory. You know, well, why did you feel scared for no apparent reason? What's up with that? It might be something that someone in that person's life has already said to them, and they're sitting there going, I don't know. If I had the answer, I probably wouldn't be talking to you. Heading into that diagnostic area, oh, it looks like you've been having panic attacks. Don't worry, they're very, very common. We want to reassure our patients, and often our patients, you know, really are kind of wanting, you know, to sort of really understand what's going on for them. But, you know, a couple of check boxes don't mean panic attacks. There's a lot more information that we need. So I normally just sort of say, look, this is what I'm noticing. I'm noticing these are the things that are really top of mind for you. These are the really capturing your attention, like trembling or, you know, racing heart. Is that what's going on? And what can you tell me what that looks like? Tell me what that actually looks like for you when it happens. Mm-hmm. You get a lot more information that way.
I'd probably avoid using the terminology higher scores. I wouldn't be referring to scores at all because we're extremely paranoid. Even when you live with a mental health condition for a long time, you know, a lot of people with mental health conditions are extremely paranoid. And if you start talking about high scores, low scores, it can create a real paranoia issue. I'd be maybe saying responses, because the scoring is for you guys. You know, the scoring's not for us. It's not a spectator sport. We're not looking to see who wins, who gets highest, lowest scores. We don't care in terms of how you want to use those scores. You use them however you like, but it's about having a conversation. Use the resource, use the questions, or more so the topics within those questions, to then have that conversation and assist us as to where we need to go next in our journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So Peter, just coming back to that question around evidence, is there any sort of qualitative evidence that we have around what consumers say?
Yeah, Luke, it's really interesting that what Dale just said is an absolute picture of qualitative evidence, in that the experiences that people have with these early sort of mental health appointments are really predictive of whether they continue treatment, do they go back or not, and whether they actually are able to benefit from it. So we know the evidence is really clear that collaborative care works better, outcomes are better when you collaborate. So inviting the patient or the client into each of these conversations as an equal is really, really important. Luke, I mean, There's just so much data that it's undeniable is that rapport is an essential part of good mental health care. Dale's point in an earlier conversation about maybe it isn't a first session thing. You know, I don't always do them in the first session. I know that there's situations in the mental health space where we do need to, and they can be useful. But yeah, I think it's you know, as the old saying goes, it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really helpful. We've discovered that many of us are using questionnaires to measure progress and change across sessions and across time. What are some of the helpful and unhelpful ways to talk about that?
Yeah, look, it certainly can be useful. Again, we don't want to put people in boxes. It's like, oh, you're normal now, or you're in the normal range, you know, achievement unlocked. That's not really what they tell us, not what we want to be saying. Talking about cure, if someone's symptoms are getting better, cure is not what's happening at all and often not necessarily the goal, or it looks like everything's better now. You know, it's really, really, you know, it can be gut-wrenching, I think, for people in the mental health system, for someone to sort of take that step back and say, well, you don't need me anymore, you don't need help or support anymore because of this number on a question there. It can make them feel quite desperate. So really what we can do and what we'll talk about in a minute is, you know, we can make those judgments and look at things like clinically meaningful change. But again, we want to be checking in, you know, I'm looking at what's going on here, and it actually looks like your anxiety's lessened. You know, it looks like it's getting better. How is everything? How is everything in terms of what you first came to see me about, but also how's treatment been going? Is it good? Is it working? What are your thoughts? Again, more questions.
Yeah. How does that sound to you, Dale?
Yeah, I think it's right. I think the other thing to be mindful is because, yeah, naturally people with a mental illness, especially something like mine with bipolar, your moods are going to change quite frequently and you know, can be too extreme. So whilst it might occur that, you know, someone's mental illness or their well-being is getting better, often we just become better at hiding it. So, you know, again, just redoing a questionnaire isn't going to give you necessarily an accurate reflection of someone's mental health at any given time. So it's still important to, again, have that that communication, the conversations to, okay, why do you think you're feeling this way? You know, why do you think, you know, you're feeling better than you were a month ago? You know, why do you think you're feeling worse? So it's, again, it's, you know, as Peter's saying, it's having that conversation.
Yeah. And we definitely don't want anybody to think that this is a score of their performance or how good they're working at their recovery or anything like that, which would be easier to fall into that trap, I think.
We judge ourselves more than anyone else. So, and I'm sure you guys are the same in terms of, you know, we all as human beings, we judge ourselves. Those with a mental health condition can be absolutely terrible judges on themselves. So we don't necessarily need to be told your scores are higher or lower because we can take either of them quite well or quite poorly.
Thank you. So as you're probably all aware, there are lots and lots of mental health questionnaires out there today. There are condition-specific ones, there are personality-specific ones, and there are all, and then somebody's raised, you know, culturally and linguistically that whether, you know, whether they're validated tools. And it's great that the DAS21 has been translated into about 20 languages, sorry, and can be easily accessed. But, you know, those are all the considerations that we have, and it can feel overwhelming sometimes, I think, and how do I know whether the questionnaire I'm using is a good one for me and good one for my patients and clients? Peter, could you just share with us what you think are the main principles to help us with that process?
Yeah, sure. I think this, I mean, you're absolutely right. There are so many questionnaires and so many things to think about. And apologies for the psychologists if this is sort of psychometrics 101, but these are the sort of things that we look for or things to really think about. So first of all, I really encourage people to read the instructions of the questionnaire and think about, well, what is it actually measuring? Is it measuring frequency or severity, for example? Is it measuring how often or how bad? Those two things are different, and they're going to give you different pieces of information. And then there's this severity versus complexity thing that I sort of struggle sometimes with some people in our health system to get them to understand those two things are different. But is it how bad or how many? So is it just measuring how bad something's going on, or is it a really broadband questionnaire that's measuring case complexity? And then thinking about a couple of the sort of, you know, golden rules of psychometrics. One is test, retest, reliability, which is if you give this to the same person over and over again, does it measure the same thing over and over again? Which you kind of think sometimes, well, wouldn't it? If you give the person to the same thing over and over again, it's going to give the same results. It doesn't always. There are ways of asking things, and there are certain types of questions that are really consistent over time, and there's some that just aren't, and you want to be using the ones that are if you're measuring change. Validity, like every psychologist loves to talk about validity, but construct and content validity are the big ones here. So construct is that, is it measuring what we think it's measuring? Is it measuring what you actually want to measure? You might have been, you know, as you said, given it in training and you give it to your patients, but well, is that actually measuring what you're interested in talking to this person about? And how much of that is measured? That's that content validity piece. So it might be measuring just a few bits and pieces of something like PTSD, but it's not measuring that whole trauma experience. Mm. So making sure that, again, we're using them for the purpose that they're intended and just seeing them as a piece, an important piece, but they're not the whole picture.
Yeah, beautiful. Tell us a bit about the DAS-21, like how it was designed and what it's for.
Yeah, the good old DAS-21. So declaring my love for the DAS-21 because it was developed at UNSW.
I love it. Yeah.
And the person who developed it is just the loveliest, you know, human being that you ever wish to meet. But really, really useful, really widely used. It gives us three different subscales. So that depression, anxiety, and stress, they're pretty robust and they're pretty what we call statistically orthogonal, which means there's not too much overlap between them. So when you get those three scores, you can sort of be, you know, relatively sure that you're measuring three different things. But I popped a quote from the researcher manual over there where it just makes it very clear that it's has no implications for diagnosis. So it's not meant to categorize someone into a diagnostic system. It measures what we call those core symptoms. So they're just symptoms that are more common. Doesn't mean they're more important than someone else's experience. And it doesn't mean if someone is experiencing something slightly different, it doesn't mean it's irrelevant. And I think one of the criticisms that often is leveled at the DAS is it doesn't have an item that measures suicidal ideation. But it's a research and a statistical decision because the suicide item in the original version, it just didn't fit with anything else. It doesn't fit with any of these factors. So while it's really interesting, we think that suicide would probably fit with something like a depression score. For this questionnaire, it just doesn't.
So talk to us about how you think we should be talking to patients about those specific scores that come through in each scale.
Yeah, so this slide and the next slide are designed to sort of print them out double-sided and use them as a little guide. So in terms of those scores on the right, there's normative categories, we call them. Those are those buckets that we like to put people in. Those are the scores that correspond to those different sort of brackets. And I've put some language in there just to sort of guide how you might describe those things. So if someone's got mild symptoms, we might say that they're feeling mostly well, but occasionally they do have some sort of periods where they're feeling anxious or stressed. In that severe bracket, it's a bit different. You know, people having these quite frequent feelings and they're starting to cause problems or they're really getting in the way of them doing what they really want to be able to do in life. So again, we're not sort of saying that they've got severe anxiety or anything like that. It's really about saying, okay, well, if someone's score is in this range, this is kind of what we know from the research. This is generally what's going on for them. What's going on for you? Does that sound familiar? Is that, you know, does that sound right? Or have we got it wrong?
Mm. And that makes a lot of sense because with the DAS, it's a frequency of symptoms as opposed to severity, isn't it? You know, they're often almost always, you know, those ones there. So, it makes sense that that's how we would explain it. And do we add all the scores up?
So in a research context, we sometimes do if we just want that one single score. But I don't think clinically it would be useful.
Yeah, And I also love the DAS 21, but I'd be interested to know from Dale, I know that you've got bipolar too, so it may not be a good measurement tool at all for you, but I know that you support a lot of other people in their mental health journeys. What's your take on the DAS 21?
I think it's the same as the others. I think I like it. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased, like Peter, because Black Dog's heavily involved, but I do like it. I use the topics within it personally to sort of use it as an ongoing measuring tool for myself, just to refresh myself and check in with myself. But I do use it when I have conversations with other people. I don't sit there and ask them the questions, you know, one by one, but I do use it not only just to sort of get them thinking about what's happening, why things are happening, but also to hopefully make things easier for you guys to prepare them a little bit so that when they do go and seek medical attention, that the questions aren't a bit more normalized, that they prepared and have put some thought into the answers. Obviously we need to be careful again that, you know, like it does say depression, anxiety, stress, you know, there's a lot of other, you know, mental illnesses that have different labels. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. You know, we need to make sure, and I know there are issues around being able to diagnose, especially bipolar type 2. So, again, you know, as we've talked about, it's not the resource, it's how it's used.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. We've talked about using a resource like the DAS 21 to monitor change over time. What's going on in the back of your mind, Peter, when you notice that scores aren't shifting or aren't changing over time?
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess I'm at a stage in my career where I can just be curious about it, but sometimes we get anxious. So it may be that we're using the wrong questionnaire. Maybe it's not depression, anxiety, or stress we're trying to measure. Maybe the scores were already relatively low. It's not, they don't have, you know, much area to go, but I mean, really, it's about the patient and talking to the patient, you know, like, are they happy with their treatment? Are they achieving what they want? Are they, is life starting to look like they hoped it could look when they actually came to see you to begin with? And so I think, you know, Dale's point earlier about, you know, health professionals also judging themselves harshly, as sometimes people in, you know, mental health consumers do. I always think that health professionals and mental health consumers are just a match made in heaven, because we do judge ourselves we love to judge ourselves really harshly. We're our own worst critics a lot, and we're often these sort of, you know, like, we really do want things to work out really well, and we're often very sort of diligent and detail oriented and push ourselves beyond our limits. And so I think, you know, DAS score's not shifting. It's not information about anything that you or the patient are doing wrong necessarily. Yeah. Sometimes it's just, again, as the theme of the night, right? It's just a starting off point for a conversation.
You're only part of the journey. You know, you're only part of the solution. At some point, you can have the best processes, the best treatment, but at some point, the patient has to actually at first admit that they have an issue, that they have a mental health illness, and then secondly, you have to say, yeah, okay, I want to do the hard yards and you know, work with my clinician to get better. Without that, you know, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, and it's that shared understanding and the shared ownership that's so important. So we're just going to talk a little bit about some online resources. You'll notice that we're not going to provide you with a comprehensive list of all the all the tools that we think are good, because there are too many and there's pros and cons for each of those to be used in different contexts. But we've already talked about some of those principles that you can use to guide you about which tools might be useful for you to be using. And then I also just wanted to highlight that there's some really great online resources embedded within programs that you may already be using. So at the Black Dog Institute, we have our online clinic, which is a free online health assessment that you could either do with the patient or the patient could do in their own free time. And what we're finding more and more is that particularly younger people are doing this off their own bat independently, and then the score prompts them to make that first appointment, and that's a great thing. But again, that is only just the beginning of the conversation. You may be familiar with This Way Up out of Vinny's, and they also have a take a test tool that has a very similar function, and MindSpot at Macquarie has the same. So, you know, very high uptake, and these are all great. They have slightly different nuances, so take a look. You can always just give it a whirl yourself and become familiar with them, but I would really recommend them all to you. There was a question in the chat box earlier around ways to present this data, and I think for some people it's quite helpful to present it in a visual way as opposed to with numbers. This is just one example of the clinician dashboard from the This Way Up program. And so if a clinician prescribes the program to somebody, as they complete each module, both the client and the clinician can see progress over those scores, as you can see here. And what's beautiful is up the top, you've got that visualization of the scores, and you can click across and see each of those different charts. So for some people, that's really useful. Of course, those three websites only host a limited number. And for those of you who are working in quite specialized settings, and particularly the clinical psychologists here, you might find that you need to, access more of those specialized mental health questionnaires, and NovaPsych and TACWIT are just two of those providers. And I believe that both of those have these types of dashboard visualization. So pretty fancy. If you're interested, definitely take a look around. If you found today's webinar interesting, then I'd like to let you know that there's all the previous 60-something webinars that are available for on-demand viewing, and also have been shortened to 30-minute podcasts. So you're very welcome to hop on and have a look on our Health Professional Resource and Education Hub. We also have a community of practice where we talk about burning issues. We have a clinical case scenario that's going at the moment about this topic itself, and lots of other resources to help you integrate digital mental health programs and tools into your practice. I'm sorry that we haven't been able to get to all the questions. I know that there's been some interesting questions around the DAS and the youth version and all of those. But if you do have any questions that we weren't able to answer, then feel free to direct those to Peter at that email address you can see on the page. So I just wanted to thank everybody so much for joining. It's been great to get to know you a little bit and see all the supportive chat in the chat box. But a particularly big thank you to Dale and Peter for sharing your wisdom with us. It is all in the application, isn't it? It's you know, that the devil is in actually how we're using this in the real world, and in a way that's collaborative and safe with our patients and clients. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your tips with us. We look forward to seeing everybody again next time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening in today. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast on making the most of mental health questionnaires. A big thank you to Peter and Dale for sharing your expertise and experience with us. All the resources and services that we've discussed are available both in the episode description on your device and via the Black Dog Institute website under the eMental Health page. Thank you so much for listening today. Until next time.